Doctor knows best used to be a mantra. These days, though, mistrust in medicine is common. How can we rebuild trust? This is The People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Political distrust during the pandemic exacerbated mistrust in medicine. This puts both patients and providers in a difficult bind.
For years, people suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome were told that their symptoms were psychosomatic. Long COVID changed that. When medicine doesn't have answers to challenging problems, doctors need to be honest.
Until physicians and patients can trust each other, shared decision-making will only be a meaningless slogan.
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, how can we rebuild faith in medicine?
In The People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, bird flu has killed millions of chickens, turkeys, and wild birds. Now, scientists are increasingly worried about this H5N1 virus spreading to cattle. Genomic analysis reveals that the virus made a jump to cows as early as December 2023. It's been moving through herds ever since. The virus is showing up in milk and meat. Federal officials are just now starting to collect samples of both to determine how far the virus has spread. It's been detected in 34 herds since the end of March. With 20% of milk samples testing positive, the virus is probably far more widespread than originally predicted. The FDA has said that preliminary tests indicate pasteurized milk is safe to drink, since the pasteurization process kills the virus. Officials warn against consuming raw milk or cheese made from raw milk. The USDA is testing ground beef with PCR, polymerase chain reaction, a technology that can detect fragments of virus. Scientists are criticizing the USDA for waiting nearly a month before releasing critical data that would allow public health officials to craft a response.
Measles outbreaks are becoming a worldwide problem. The European Society of Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases met recently in Barcelona, Spain. At those meetings, it was revealed that global measles cases have almost doubled over the last year, from 170,000 cases in 2022 to over 320,000 cases in 2023. Health officials have counted actual cases to reach those numbers, but they estimate that the true incidence is in the millions. Vaccination rates have been falling in many countries. Measles is not a benign infection. Young children may develop pneumonia, brain swelling, and severe diarrhea. In undernourished children, measles can be lethal.
About half of American adults don't get the recommended amount of exercise. Now researchers say there's an easy way to change that. A meta-analysis of 9 studies showed that people who choose the stairs instead of the elevator lower their chance of dying from heart disease compared to elevator riders. They were also less likely to suffer strokes or heart attacks. The research included data on about 480,000 individuals. Scientists from the University of East Anglia presented these data at the European Society of Cardiology Preventive Cardiology 2024 Congress. They point out that even short bouts of stair climbing can improve cardiovascular fitness and increase muscle strength at the same time. Stair climbers were 24% less likely to die during the study time frame compared to those who did not climb. When the investigators considered cardiovascular disease and mortality, climbing stairs reduced the odds by about 39%. While any exercise is better than none, researchers encourage people to incorporate taking the stairs into their day. If you count steps with a fitness tracker on your wrist, you can probably use it to count flights climbed, too. Aiming for 6 to 10 flights a day should provide plenty of benefit.
Atrial fibrillation is the most common serious irregular heart rhythm. The CDC estimates that by 2030, over 12 million Americans will be diagnosed with AFib. This arrhythmia has been thought to be far more common in older people, but new data suggests that almost 1/4 of those diagnosed with AFib are under 65. This study involved 67,000 patients. Younger people with AFib were more likely to have risk factors such as diabetes, hypertension, COPD, and coronary artery disease. Symptoms of AFib may include heart palpitations, lightheadedness, fatigue, irregular heartbeats, and chest pain. Smartwatches are often capable of detecting this irregular heart rhythm. That may partially explain why so many younger people are being diagnosed than in prior years. It's important to treat this condition with anticoagulants or ablation therapy to prevent blood clots that could cause strokes. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. There was a time when the phrase, "doctor knows best," was widely accepted. Television shows of the 70s, like Marcus Welby, M.D., depicted doctors as wise and kind. In contrast, many people today don't trust doctors. All the divisiveness during COVID has taken a toll.
To learn how to rebuild trust, we turn to Dr. Perry Wilson. He's a nephrologist, epidemiologist, and associate professor at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Wilson is the author of How Medicine Works and When It Doesn't, Learning Who to Trust to Get and Stay Healthy.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Perry Wilson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Wilson, you introduce your book with a story about Mrs. Myers, a woman who you describe as frustrated, angry, desperate, and also sad. And her interactions with modern medicine had been to, I say, maybe loosely, were disappointing. What happened during your visit with Mrs. Myers to make it even worse?
Yeah, this happened back when I was a resident working at the hospital at the University of Pennsylvania in my general internal medicine clinic. And I saw this woman. I was, I think, the fifth or sixth doctor she had seen for a slew of symptoms that were really all over her body. Diffuse fatigue, random joint aches and pains. And she had had, you know, every test in the book, ranging from testing for lupus to testing for pregnancy, which is something that we, you know, always have to check for. Variety of scans, and everything had come up normal, but she knew deep down that something was wrong. And she had come to me, you know, as this long chain of doctors to potentially figure it out. And at this point in my career, I thought, you know, okay, I know what I'm doing now. I'm a kind and empathetic person. I want to help people. And I'm listening to her and the way she's describing her symptoms. And the thing that comes up in my mind is that, you know, she may well have major depressive disorder. This may be what we call the somatic or body manifestations of depression. And I brought that up as a possibility and just saw her completely disconnect from the encounter. That was not what she wanted to hear. That's not what she wanted to hear in that way. And it was like a door closed between us. And I realized in that moment I had lost the opportunity to help her, even though I thought I was doing the right thing. The sort of coda to the story is that she didn't follow up with me in my clinic a month later as we had scheduled, which wasn't terribly surprising, but I did see her again. I saw her in the emergency room about a year later after suffering a seizure, which had been brought on by the excessive consumption of water. That's something that many people aren't aware of, but your body is quite good at getting rid of excess water that you drink. That's what your kidneys do, after all, but only to a point. And it is possible to drink so much water that you can reduce your electrolytes in your blood enough that you can have real problems, including seizures. And that's what had happened to her. She had been on essentially a cleanse that had been prescribed by an alternative practitioner who was diagnosing her with you know, a variety of toxins, including heavy metal poisoning, despite no real concrete evidence that that was the case or particular exposures that would have led her to get heavy metal poisoning. And she had this, you know, what I consider a terrible outcome of this line of treatment, an unorthodox line of treatment, certainly led to a seizure and an emergency room visit. But what struck me was actually how happy she was when I went to see her. She had never felt better, she said, you know, despite the seizure that had happened, she believed in the therapy she was doing, the cleanses and the drinks. She had found a community of people with similar symptoms that shared their stories and supported her as she was working through this. And it struck me in that moment that, as, you know, science-based as I am and I was brought up in the kind of traditional medical system, that we can fail our patients even when we provide the best medical advice if we haven't established that bond of trust, if we haven't really understood where they are coming from and made them believe that we're on the same side. And although I don't endorse the sort of bizarre, you know, anti-toxin practices that she was doing, the fact that she found a community really might have been therapeutic. And to some extent, that's a microcosm of medicine writ large to me. We fail our patients by focusing sometimes so exclusively on them that we miss the fact that we are living in a society that's increasingly fragmented and isolated. And I think a lot of medical ills these days might be attributable to that, to loneliness, to lack of community.
Right. And of course, medicine, doctors can't prescribe community. At least most doctors can't or don't. It seems to me, Dr. Wilson, that a lot of people might have had an experience like Mrs. Myers without the seizures. People who have chronic fatigue syndrome, even people who have something as simple as Hashimoto's thyroiditis, people now with long COVID, they may go into the doctor, they may say, I don't feel good, here are the problems. And the doctor says, you need to see a psychiatrist. And what the patient hears is, it's all in your head. It's not real.
And that creates a lack of trust. I mean, for decades, people with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome were basically told, it's all in your head. And I suspect that now, with long COVID, they're saying, well, we told you so. We've been suffering for all this time. And now you're kind of recognizing that an infection can indeed lead to long, complicated, fatigue-like symptoms.
Yeah, I in some ways, I'm thankful. This is going to sound odd, but, you know, I'm thankful for long COVID being such a so present in the sort of zeitgeist in the discussions both between patients and doctors nowadays, because it's the first time really that you've seen a lot of hardcore research, you know, real blood and guts type of research into a condition that is not truly life-threatening. And I'm being very careful with that definition. You know, long COVID can have some incredibly serious manifestations. It is no doubt life-altering. But one of the problems of medical research is that so much money and effort is focused on life-threatening diseases, whether it's, you know, life-threatening cardiovascular disease, diabetes, stroke, cancer, etc. That's where, to be honest, the money is. When I apply for an NIH grant, I have to say what the impact is. That's a major component of the grant. You know, what is the significance here? And the best way you can say that is, oh, well, you know, X many million of people die every year from this terrible, you know, thing. And please fund us to stop that, because death is a horrible thing. And it certainly is. But what that means is that doctors are sort of trained to rule out things that are going to kill you. And once they're sure that nothing's going to kill you, it becomes much less clear what to do. And that's why a lot of these syndromes, including a variety of, I mean, I'm not saying long COVID is a psychiatric syndrome, but this includes a lot of more mild psychiatric syndromes, maybe not even rising to the level of major depression, but something like what the psychiatrist would call dysthymia, which is, you know, the sort of generalized malaise and sadness, don't get the attention they deserve, because a doctor can in good conscience say, well, you're okay, yeah, I understand, you don't feel great, but you're alive, your heart's beating, your blood pressure's fine, and so on. And in order to rebuild that trust with our patients, I think, honestly, it's time we have to do more than say, listen, you're not going to die of this thing, so, you know, go on and go be happy. We have to try to improve their lives. We have to improve quality of life, not just, you know, the duration of life.
Well, trust really is a major theme of your super duper book, How Medicine Works and When It Doesn't. But trust, it's not an automatic thing. And it has to go both ways, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's not something that can happen in the first few minutes of a visit. In fact, if you find yourself, you know, deeply trusting a provider, you know, within the first couple of minutes that you've met them, that's maybe a red flag. You haven't had enough discussion yet. It absolutely goes both ways. You know, the doctor-patient relationship is incredibly intimate. You tell your doctor, in many cases, things that you're not even necessarily going to tell your spouse. It is also not, let's be honest, a relationship where there is an even footing. Because the doctor, at the very least, is the one sitting there with a prescription pad. You know, the years of training and the promise, however latent, that they can maybe help you with your problem. So there is a power dynamic there, and it's sort of wrong to think that that it doesn't exist. But it can work both ways, and the way it works both ways is by openly acknowledging these facts. The doctor saying to the patient, "Listen, you know, my expectation of you is that you're honest with me. You're going to tell me what's wrong. You're going to tell me what you're scared of. You're going to tell me what you're doing and what you're not doing, what you're taking and what you're not taking." And the patient's job is to trust that the doctor has their best interests at heart. And that is something that a lot of people out there are invested in sowing doubt about. There's a whole alternative medicine, anti-medicine complex that profits from the idea that physicians are actually not looking out for their patients' best interests. They're looking out for their own bottom line. They're looking out to avoid getting sued, et cetera. And I'm not saying every physician is a saint by any stretch. But if you are not able to come to that point where you actually believe that your doctor, the one sitting in front of you, wants what's best for you, then you either have to find a new doctor or find a way to get to that point.
You're listening to Dr. Perry Wilson, associate professor at the Yale School of Medicine. He's the author of How Medicine Works and When It Doesn't, Learning Who to Trust to Get and Stay Healthy.
After the break, we'll talk about how we can interact with a physician to try to regain some trust.
What is motivated reasoning, and how does it cause trouble?
People hate flip-flops in medical advice. But scientific research reveals new insights that leads to changes in old recommendations.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by CocoVia Dietary Supplements. May is National Physical Fitness and Sports Month, Consider how Cocovia could be a part of your nutrition and exercise routine. More information at cocovia.com.
We just heard about a patient who resented being told that her physical symptoms might be psychological. A lot of people have had that experience, and it undermines their trust in the medical profession. Others have seen how monetary motivation can shape the treatments that physicians offer. That can make them cynical about medical recommendations.
And then there are changes in guidelines. Should you use margarine or butter on your breakfast toast? Or do you need to skip the toast altogether and stick with green smoothies? What should you believe? Where can you find a trustworthy source?
To get answers to some of these questions, we're talking with Dr. Perry Wilson. He's a nephrologist, epidemiologist, and associate professor at the Yale School of Medicine. His research focuses on using data and analytics to personalize medicine for each individual. Dr. Wilson is the director of the Yale Clinical and Translational Research Accelerator and co-director of the Yale Section of Nephrology, Human Genetics, and Clinical Research Corps. He's a columnist at Medscape, where he hosts a popular series called The Impact Factor. It analyzes the strengths and weaknesses of published studies. Dr. Wilson is the author of How Medicine Works and When It Doesn't, Learning Who to Trust to Get and Stay Healthy.
Dr. Wilson, we recently had an opportunity to talk with Dr. David Newman-Toker, who is probably the country's leading expert on diagnostic errors. And he paints a pretty grim picture, suggesting that as many as 10% of diagnoses may be incorrect. And of course, when that happens, it's like the train goes off the tracks before it even gets started. You talk about trust and how important that is. If a patient begins to have some doubts, what should the patient say to the doctor? And I'm thinking about things like, you know, Lyme disease, where people say, but I think I have Lyme disease. And the doctor is saying, oh, no, couldn't be. There's no Lyme disease in this part of the country. So help us understand how to interact with a physician to reestablish some degree of trust.
Sure. Yeah. You know, diagnosis is the first and arguably most important job of the physician. It's what we spend so much time learning. And there are two types of errors in diagnostics. One is an error of commission, right? I give you the wrong diagnosis. I tell you you have a thyroid disease when you actually don't. One is that an error of omission. I fail to note the proper diagnosis. And this is one that I think actually happens quite a bit more often. We just miss something that's going on. I think this is best answered with a story. When I first became an attending physician, so now I had interns and residents reporting to me, often in the middle of the night, you know, with new patients coming in and they've seen the patient, they've examined them, and they call you on the phone and they want to run the case by you, which is, of course, appropriate, but it's a quick call. You know, this is how old they are. This is the symptoms. You know, here's what I think is going on. And I realized early on that the way the interns and residents present the case is to prove that their diagnosis is correct, right? They think this patient is having a heart attack, and here's all the evidence that supports that they're having a heart attack, and it makes a very compelling story in a few minutes. What I learned is that the best question to ask them after they present this is, interesting, what else could this be? And that question all of a sudden resets the conversation. It's like, okay, I've been arguing this whole time that it's a heart attack, and maybe I still think this is a heart attack, but all right, you asked. Well, I suppose it could be a pulmonary embolism. You know, I suppose it could be a pneumonia or a lung infarct or, you know, a rib fracture or all these other sort of things. And patients can use that to talk to their doctors when they're not as confident in the diagnosis. You're not challenging. You're not necessarily saying, I disagree, you know, doctor, you know, you're wrong. I know what's going on here. You just say, thank you. I'm going to read all about what you told me I have. What else could this be? And it's an open dialogue that forces the doctor to do what we should be doing all the time, which is what we call differential diagnosis. Keep multiple things on the table and cross them off the list one at a time systematically. Do not become wedded to one diagnosis keep the others on the list until you can prove that they don't belong there.
Dr. Wilson, part of the story that you just told us goes to one of the behaviors that you describe in your book, something called that you call motivated reasoning. And I think this is something that all humans do, but it can get us into trouble. Can you tell us a bit more about that, please?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think this is the central problem of society today. I could probably talk about it for an hour and a half. Motivated reasoning is finding facts that support a conclusion that you want to be true. And we live in a world that is full of data. We have access now, you know, we have access to the sum of the world's knowledge at our fingertips, on the phone, in our pocket. It's unbelievable. And a lot of the stuff that you can find on the internet is true, and a lot is false. And it's trivial to find false information that supports an idea that you want to be true. And that's what motivated reasoning is. It explains so much. I had a patient once who was 50 years old, smoked a pack a day. And I was telling him, you know, you should stop smoking. And he said, well, you know, my dad smoked until he was 90 and lived to be 95, you know, so it's fine. Okay, that's a point of data. It is one point amidst a sea, an ocean of data that suggests that smoking is, you know, a terrible thing for your health. But this patient was motivated, you know, he didn't want to quit smoking. He was motivated to find a way for himself to believe that that he would be okay. And one of the things that I've learned in studying this is that motivated reasoning really tends to defend the status quo. We don't like change. Change is difficult. And so whenever we feel pressure to change, we often look for data that says, no, you know what, you're fine, right? We look for the data that says, oh, you know, it's okay to drink a couple of glasses of wine a night, you know, even if maybe more data suggests we should cut back, you know, it's okay to keep smoking. It's, you know, it's okay to not get too much exercise, because you can find that. But when, of course, you look systematically and you really are honest with yourself, you know that to be healthy, we really do have to make changes. And it is not easy. But once you acknowledge that and you sort of tell yourself, no, I actually have to do this, I actually have to go and get up and get exercise, it makes it slightly easier to do that, and you will get healthier.
Well, you know, Dr. Wilson, your colleagues are also susceptible to motivated reasoning. And I'm thinking back to dietary guidelines. I mean, I remember when margarine was the answer to heart disease.
Yeah.
No cholesterol. Eggs were evil.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you have cream in your coffee, oh my goodness, you're going to have a heart attack.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we now know that a lot of that was just not true. And in fact, hydrogenated fats in margarine were probably causing more harm than good. But boy, the American Heart Association had a hard time changing direction. We can talk about statins.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about, you know, randomized controlled trials. And I know that's a very important part of your philosophy. But how do we get health professionals to also recognize that they're sort of guilty of motivated reasoning?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I often call one simple thing medicine. You see this all over, both in traditional medicine and in alternative practices. You know, one superfood to improve your cognition in later life. You know, one 2-minute exercise to give you washboard abs. You know, one food to avoid no matter what. These are super appealing narratives because they're easy, right? If you told me that if I ate 3 kale leaves a day, I'd have a 6-pack abdomen, and that were true, I mean, I'd be very excited. I'm very motivated to believe something like that. But of course, it's not true. And the dietary guidelines suffer from this a lot, particular those studies that focus on single ingredients, you know, eggs, red wine, coffee, etc. The truth is, our diets are incredibly complicated. And in order to change the trajectory of your health, I mean, I hate to say this, it's always like no one wants to hear that it's hard, but it is hard. Change is difficult. Removing cream from your coffee, removing eggs from your diet, those one simple things, really, there's no evidence that they're going to change the long-term trajectory. It's much bigger changes if you really want to make a difference. And when it comes to diet, you know, it's on the order of, oh, changing to a vegetarian diet or a pescatarian diet, changing to a vegan diet. You know, these things will affect your health in the long term. I am not a vegan or a vegetarian or a pescatarian. It's not easy. I like the way I'm eating. But that's what I tell my patients when they come in. They say, wait, are almonds good for me now or bad for me now and stuff? I say, you know what? It's not one thing. It's everything. And the best I can tell people to do, the simplest I can tell people to do when it comes to diet, I say, listen, just stay on the outside rim of the supermarket, right? You know, fresh foods, fresh vegetables, stay away from the processed stuff as much as possible. If you can manage to do that, and of course, there's some socioeconomic reasons why people are not able to do that. But if you're able to do that, you're okay. And don't worry too much about whether you're having enough quinoa in your diet.
Now, we also do it with drugs. We often speak with cardiologists who say, you know, statins, they're the greatest drugs that have ever been developed. In fact, they should probably be in the water supply or in the salt shaker so that everybody gets a statin. And yet when we look at primary prevention, that is to say people who have elevated cholesterol but no heart disease, the benefits are complicated and even a little bit confusing as to whether or not they're going to save any lives. And the number needed to treat, and our listeners have heard this quite frequently, is pretty high. You know, you have to,
yeah,
a lot of people have to take a statin to prevent one heart attack.
Right.
Help us understand this whole concept of motivated reasoning when it comes to pharmaceuticals.
Well, doctors are actually pretty bad at understanding the likelihood of benefit of a pharmaceutical on an individual patient level. So let me explain that. Our big randomized trials, you know, you take thousands of people, half get placebo, half get a statin, for example, show the effects of a drug on a population level. It says, hey, if we treat, you know, 10,000 people with a statin, we'll save 300 people from having a heart attack or something like that. And that's great. Heart attacks are terrible. You know, the catch, of course, is that we don't know who those 300 people are to begin with. We have to treat the 10,000 to save the 300. Now, that might be a trade-off that is worthwhile. That's, you know, there's no magic number. It depends on the cost and the side effects of the drug. The number needed to treat for wearing your seatbelt, for example, to prevent a fatal car crash or to prevent dying in a fatal car crash is about 10,000. It means 10,000 of us need to wear our seatbelts to save one person's life when they get in a car accident. And mostly that's because most of us aren't going to get in a fatal car accident. You know, we're going to wear our seatbelt every time we drive, and it's never actually going to matter for us. But of course, we do it because it's not hard to wear your seatbelt. There's no side effects, really. And in fact, I kind of find it more comfortable now. And so we have to think of both the benefits and the risks when it comes to things like statins. But it does turn out that doctors are pretty good at estimating a patient's risk of an event, like a heart attack. If you say, hey, how likely is this patient to have a heart attack in the next 10 years? And they give you a percentage, they're pretty accurate. You know, oh, 5, 10, 15%, depending on risk factors, et cetera. If you ask, how likely do you think this patient is to benefit from a statin? Or really, this is true of any drug. Doctors vastly overestimate the likelihood of benefit. Because most people, for most drugs, actually in a reasonable time frame are not going to experience the thing you are trying to prevent. You know, am I going to have a heart attack in the next 5 years? Probably not, whether or not I take a statin. So a statin's not really benefiting me. This is a complicated concept. And the problem is that doctors, as I said, don't know in advance who is going to benefit from the drug and who isn't. So the only logical thing to do is treat everyone who's eligible to maximize the amount of people who can benefit. But it also explains why patients might decide rationally that they don't want to take that drug. Because while the doctor gets to treat 1,000 patients and save some lives if he can give them all statins, as a patient, it's just you. And so if you think that the likelihood that you'll benefit is not worth the risk of side effects or cost of the drug, it may be rational to tell your doctor that you don't want to go down that path, just as it's rational for the doctor to suggest that everyone should be treated with this drug. So it's a really interesting dichotomy, depending on whether you're treating a 1,000 people or for public health officials, 300 million people, or if you're only one person.
That is such an important point. And I think the other thing that we need to keep in mind is that medical science, like all of our science, actually changes. What we know is not engraved in stone forever. And I wish you would tell us the story about treating sepsis. You have a lovely story in the book about a patient with sepsis that you were treating with IV fluids.
Sure. So this is back in my training days. I was in the intensive care unit at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. I guess we're 2008 or so. And the sepsis guidelines had come out based on a randomized trial by a guy named Manny Rivers, which suggested, amongst other things, very aggressive fluid resuscitation, which means giving IV fluids to these patients with sepsis. And it had become something of a macho contest to see kind of who would give the most fluids. It was so obvious that that was the right thing to do. In the morning, when you'd talk about the case, you'd say, yeah, I gave this guy, 10 liters overnight, and then people would pat you on the back. Well, years passed, and those trials were done again and in different places and with slightly different patient populations. And what we learned is actually giving that much fluid is potentially harmful. You stress the heart, you stress the lungs, et cetera. And we cut way back on the amount of fluids we give in sepsis. We weren't wrong originally. We were acting on the best evidence we had at the time, and then the evidence got better. Things changed. The patient population changed, but also we did larger, better studies to get more information. And we were right back then, given the data we had, to give those people a ton of fluids, just as we're right now to not give people so many fluids. That's not a flaw in the system. It's actually proof that the system is working. It's why medicine keeps getting better. It's actually why people's life expectancies keep going up. That is sort of the magic of science. And so when doctors, change their mind and, now we do this thing that's different than we used to do, that's actually a sign the system is working.
You're listening to Dr. Perry Wilson. He's an epidemiologist, nephrologist, and associate professor at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Wilson is also co-director of the Yale Section of Nephrology, Human Genetics, and Clinical Research Corps, and director of Yale Clinical and Translational Research Accelerator. The column he writes at Medscape is called The Impact Factor. In it, he analyzes the strengths and weaknesses of published studies. His latest book is How Medicine Works and When It Doesn't, Learning Who to Trust to Get and Stay Healthy.
After the break, we'll consider how to repair the doctor-patient relationship.
What are the four things doctors must do to earn our trust?
We're proponents of collaborative e-patient-type relationships in which patients are thoroughly engaged. How can we get doctors on board?
What institutional changes are needed to rebuild trust between patients and doctors?
We'll learn how doctors could get on the front line of change.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements. May is National Physical Fitness and Sports Month. Consider how Cocovia could be a part of your nutrition and exercise regimen. More information at cocovia.com.
Terry and I helped found the Society for Participatory Medicine. This organization has been at the forefront of the e-patient movement, in which patients and health professionals actively collaborate and encourage one another as full partners in healthcare. Shared decision-making, rather than automatically accepting that doctor knows best, is key to this approach. How can we expand this vision at a time when many practitioners are short on time and overwhelmed?
Our guest today is Dr. Perry Wilson, who is a nephrologist, epidemiologist, and associate professor at the Yale School of Medicine. His research focuses on using data and analytics to personalize medicine for each individual. Dr. Wilson is the director of the Yale Clinical and Translational Research Accelerator and co-director of the Yale Section of Nephrology, Human Genetics, and Clinical Research Corps. He's a columnist at Medscape, where he hosts a popular series called The Impact Factor. It analyzes the strengths and weaknesses of published studies. Dr. Wilson is the author of How Medicine Works and When It Doesn't, Learning Who to Trust to Get and Stay Healthy.
Dr. Wilson, you talk about repairing the doctor-patient relationship. And I can't think of anything that's more important in medicine right now, because there is a lot of suspicion, a lot of mistrust. I think you mentioned that doctors in the U.S. are ranked number 23 compared to other advanced countries in terms of trust. So first of all, I'm going to ask you about the four things you say that doctors must do to earn trust, starting with honesty.
Sure. Honesty means we need to tell our patients when we are unsure of something. The world rewards certainty. You know, the internet rewards certainty. I am sure of this. And patients want to hear that. They want to hear that I can fix you. Things are going to get better. But it isn't the truth. Medicine is a game of percentages. We are working on the best possible data we have, but it explains why we're wrong sometimes. We make the wrong diagnosis. We try a treatment. It doesn't always work. And we have to be upfront at the beginning. Look, we're in some sense taking our best guess. We're knowledgeable as can be, but it isn't perfect. There is an art here. And it's important to be clear about that. We also talk about transparency. We need to let our patients know, you know, where we're coming from, certainly what our conflicts of interests are. We need to tell them what our personal beliefs are and how we would treat ourselves and our family members, because to some extent, we are bringing our patients into our world. They need to feel like we care about them just the same as we care about, you know, the people who are closest to us. That is the basis of a strong relationship. Integrity. We need to make our patients feel that our number one and really our only goal is to advance their well-being, not necessarily save their life, or not only to save their life, but to improve their quality of life, and that we're not making decisions based on, you know, what we're going to charge or whether we're going to get sued for malpractice. And that is hard, as I mentioned before, because there are a lot of people who are trying to undermine that aspect of the relationship. And finally, validation. We need to listen and understand and tell our patients that they are right to feel the way that they feel. You know, if they're upset about their condition, no matter whether it's a life-threatening condition, a life-altering condition, or neither, we need to validate that they are seeing us because of some suffering, and our job is to alleviate suffering in whatever form it comes in. And we have to embrace that job if we're going to build trust.
We've been part of what's called the e-patient movement. Dr. Tom Ferguson was my best friend. He got his medical degree from Yale, where you are now, and he was sort of the father of e-patients, the idea that it's a collaborative effort, that it's a partnership, and that patients have a lot that they can offer that relationship. How do we help physicians understand the importance of e-patients, especially now in the world of the internet, where people do have access to tremendous amounts of information?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's much more challenging than it used to be. Before the age of the internet, patients would come in and describe some symptoms, and the doctor would say, "Oh, well, here's your diagnosis," and there was really no back and forth. It was very sort of patriarchal in some ways, or paternalistic. I much prefer an informed patient now. It's way better, not only on that first visit, but on subsequent visits, because I've said, okay, I think this is what's going on. And then the next time I see the patient, they come back and they said, okay, well, I read about that. And have you heard about this drug? And what do you think of this? But it does make things more complicated because there is bad information out there. And so 100%, I want my patients and all patients to be, to be doing their own research, to learn about the disease, to learn about treatments, to talk to people and bring that information to the doctor. Patients bring us lots of really useful information. At the same time, patients have to be willing when a doctor says, you know, I understand where you heard that thing, but I'm fairly confident that it's not true because of the potential damage that medical misinformation can do and how much of it is out there. And it can be very disappointing. If you have a cancer diagnosis and you come to your doctor and tell them, you know, I was reading a blog that said, as long as I cut out all carbohydrates from my diet, my cancer will go away. That is a hopeful thing. And that sounds way better to me than chemotherapy, but it isn't true. And it's the doctor is obligated, ethically and morally to say that, you know, I wish that were the case, but it's not. And to be able to have that kind of conversation, those are tough conversations, but it's that bridge of trust where you truly believe that they're looking out for your best interests that saves lives in those situations. And when that trust isn't there and that relationship falls apart, you know, I've seen and I've heard many stories of patients who unfortunately essentially die for lack of trust in medical care.
Dr. Wilson, are there institutional changes that need to happen to help us rebuild that trust between patients and doctors?
Oh my, yes. I mean, there's so much patients and doctors can do together, particularly in the United States, to help here. One of the shocking things I came across in researching this book is that there are currently 10 administrators for every doctor in the United States, 10 healthcare administrators. It is just insane the amount of administrative overhead there is due to, you know, multiple private insurance companies, ongoing contract negotiations. Medicine in many ways has become commoditized. I tell my trainees this. I say, you know, you guys have to realize that as physicians, you are not management. You are labor. 70% of physicians in the United States are employed by a corporation. They are not in their own private practice. 70%. That means we have more in common with, you know, the auto workers in Detroit than we do with the C-suite executives who are telling us that we only have 10 minutes to see a patient, to see a new patient visit. So this does need to change, and it needs active lobbying and advocacy from doctors and patients alike to say, you know what, this is unacceptable. We cannot see a new patient in 10 minutes. You cannot force us to see 50 or 60 patients in a day. If your health system is not profitable without us doing that, then you need to find somewhere else to cut. And there's, you know, probably a few of those 10 administrators who you might be able to do without.
Well, now, Dr. Wilson, I'm going to reveal that I am so old that I remember as a child, Dr. Hicks, the family physician, made house calls. He actually would drive up in his beat up old jalopy and had his little black bag. And, you know, for many decades, doctors were sort of independent entrepreneurs, so to speak. They had an office in their home and or at an office. And maybe there were two or three doctors who grouped together. But now you have private equity firms owning, for example, emergency medicine practices.
Yeah.
You have something called an RVU. Can you tell us what an RVU is and why it's like piecework?
Sure. An RVU stands for relative value unit. And every medical thing that you can do, whether it's an office visit or an aspiration of a cyst or heart surgery, has a specific number of RVUs attached to it. And every doctor who works for a corporation, which is 70% of us in the country, have basically what's called an RVU target to hit over the course of a year. And if you hit your RVU target, you make your salary. If you go above it, you might even get a bonus. But what it essentially is doing is putting the onus on the physician to do as much as they possibly can to deliver as much care as possible, not necessarily irrespective of what kind of quality they're doing, which of course leads to these situations where you've got, 10 minutes per visit and you're seeing 40 patients in a day. What's worse is that most of these corporations will see how many RVUs you did in a given year and then up your target for the following year. So it kind of ratchets over time to make it such that you just need to go harder and harder and harder. There's a huge problem.
Well, you know what this this reminds me of? I Love Lucy. And
the famous chocolate, right, exactly.
The chocolate on the conveyor belt, they just keep coming faster and faster.
I thought,
what are we going to do? There are too many chocolates, and they're starting to eat the chocolates. And it seems like those RVUs are forcing doctors to do more and more in less time. And you say, okay, doctors are now labor. And you ask the question, why aren't doctors on the front line of change? Well, how does that happen? Because I know patients don't like it, and I know a lot of your colleagues don't like it. So it sounds like something has to give.
I think something will give. I am not sure what it is. I'm not sure if the spiraling healthcare costs themselves in this country will just collapse the house of cards, and you'll just start seeing, these large scale institutions, kind of falling down, or whether there'll be more of a soft landing here. I think there's an economic rationale for why things have to give. I think as doctors become more frustrated, we don't talk about this much. Doctors don't have a union. We don't think of ourselves as labor, and I am deliberately, one of the doctors who tries to put that in our heads, because we still see ourselves as sort of, we have, there are nurses, and aren't the nurses working for us? Well, no, they're not. They're working for the same corporation you are. I think there are, if we can get this into doctors' heads, they might be better at advocating for change. Now, we can't go on strike. It's quite a bit more difficult because obviously it would be unethical for us to refuse to deliver care. But there are some interesting ways around that. We can not bill for what we do. And that is something that if doctors, particularly within large healthcare systems, organized and did even for a few days, it would, I think, engender some substantial change very quickly. Now, my job is not to be a labor organizer here, but I'm happy to talk about it and maybe inspire some people.
Well, I'd like to go back, if I may, to the issue of trust and how, since trust has become so eroded between doctors and patients, how can we rebuild it?
It may take some time. It's hard to overestimate how much COVID has shifted how people view healthcare in the United States. It was a traumatic experience that we all shared. Doctors experienced a lot of this trauma ourselves. I was in the hospital treating COVID patients for much of the early part of the pandemic. The relationship between the public and public health officials was completely soured during the pandemic. So there's quite a bit of work to do. My hope is that we need to define sort of a new narrative about medicine. Medicine as a team sport. I use the term therapeutic alliance. I like that. I like the idea that doctors and patients are on the same side in some kind of battle against, you know, against whether it's disease or against death. We are working together. It's going to require doctors to start to learn that their patients are facing things that aren't necessarily what they were taught in med school. It's not just high cholesterol and cancer. It's loneliness. It's social isolation. There's a reason that deaths of despair, that's, you know, suicide, drug overdose, and alcohol-related deaths are skyrocketing in this country. And it is because essentially of social fragmentation and loneliness. And that's not really taught in med school. And it needs to be. Because it's our job. Like, you know, this is our lane. Our job is to alleviate suffering, capital S. And I don't care if that comes from a heart attack or that comes from not feeling like you are part of a community, or whether it's because you don't feel like there is any upside, that there's no path for advancement in your life, or that your kids will be worse off than you. These are all things doctors need to acknowledge, or else they're really not delivering the best possible care they can to their patients.
Dr. Perry Wilson, thank you so much for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Perry Wilson, epidemiologist, nephrologist, and associate professor at the Yale School of Medicine. His research focuses on using data and analytics to personalize medicine for each individual. Dr. Wilson is also co-director of the Yale Section of Nephrology, Human Genetics and Clinical Research Corps, and director of the Yale Clinical and Translational Research Accelerator. The column he writes at Medscape is called The Impact Factor. In it, he analyzes the strengths and weaknesses of published studies. His latest book is How Medicine Works and When It Doesn't, Learning Who to Trust to Get and Stay Healthy.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show, Al Wodarski engineered, Dave Graydon edits our interviews, B.J. Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, with The People's Pharmacy.
The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements. May is National Physical Fitness and Sports Month. Consider how Cocovia could be a part of your nutrition and exercise routine. More information at cocovia.com.
Today's show is number 1384. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. That's where you could share your comments about today's interview. You can also reach us through email. We're radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider. You'll find the show on our website on Monday morning. This week, you'll find answers to a few questions about kidney health, as well as thoughts on randomized controlled trials.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you could sign up for our free online newsletter to get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also get regular access to information about our weekly podcast, so you know ahead of time which topics we'll be covering.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thanks so much for listening. Please do join us again next week.